Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Not long ago, President Trump was counting on a booming economy to power his campaign for re-election, but the coronavirus pandemic, an economic crisis, and a growing protest movement around police brutality and Black Lives Matter have changed everything, and the news keeps coming. Yesterday, the U.S. reported nearly 39,000 new coronavirus cases. The president retweeted a racist video. And polls suggest that former Vice President Joe Biden now has the advantage. But we're still 127 days away from Election Day, which is a lifetime in politics, and things can change fast. All this week, we're looking ahead to the 2020 election, digging into key issues to help you make sense of it all. This hour on Point, an update on the 2020 presidential campaign amidst a pandemic, an economic crisis, and a racial justice movement. Joining me for the first part of the program, at least, is Kimberly Atkins. She's a senior news correspondent based in Washington, D.C. for WBUR. She covers national politics. And Kimberly, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
So let's just dive right into this question. I gave a little bit of a laundry list about some of the challenges facing the nation and the president's re-election prospects. How do you frame this race? Sort of set it up for us right now.
Yeah, I think that is exactly right. Everything that we have been seeing in polling and in terms of momentum in the 2020 presidential race paints this as of this moment, an election that will be a referendum on the response to the pandemic. That has become the number one top issue, along with the other ones that you mentioned. I mean, I was looking at the most recent Gallup poll that asked folks what the most important issues in this election are, And one is the pandemic and the response to that. Two is the Black Lives Matter movement and the sort of reckoning that the nation is having over race right now. And three is the government / poor leadership, which I think can be reflected on the first two. It's sort of an underline under both of them. And in that respect, that shows why President Trump has been trailing in a lot of the polls that we've been seeing, particularly in some key battleground states. He's dropping behind Joe Biden by double digits at some time at times when Biden has really been kept from the campaign trail. So these are big, powerful issues that are on the minds of voters at this moment. We still have 4 months to go, and a lot can change. We know how much can change. You know, 4 or 5 months ago, we were talking about the impeachment. So we know that it's plenty of time. But as of right now, the pandemic and the response by the federal government is really doing a lot of damage to the president's reelection campaign.
Yeah, and let's you mentioned the polls, Kimberly. I'm just looking at the New York Times, Siena College, most recent set of polls from six battleground states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, of course, were key in handing Trump the presidency in 2016. They've added Florida, Arizona, and North Carolina. And Biden has an edge in these states anywhere from 7% to as high as 11% in Michigan and Wisconsin. So any way you slice it, this looks like a steep climb for the president to get back into this race in a meaningful way. What are you hearing from either the White House or the Trump campaign itself? There seems to be an acknowledgement that things aren't where they should be. What's the response by the president or his campaign to right this ship?
Well, it doesn't seem to be a clear agenda, at least not one that is shared by the president and his team. We've seen increasing reporting that members of the campaign team are concerned about this messaging, are concerned that this pandemic is really damaging the campaign, and they're looking for a way to sort of reset. But we also see at the same time the president really double down, triple down, quadruple down on the same approach that he took in 2016 in getting his election, which is sort of fomenting the culture wars, fomenting division, even in some of the tweets that we've seen from over the weekend and from his rhetoric. He has taken a very strong law and order stand, which is pro-police. He talks and tweets very condemningly about protesters, for example, and he's very defensive and likes to cast blame when it comes to the response over the pandemic. Campaign clearly wants him to focus more on setting himself apart from Joe Biden and really making this a choice between the president and Joe Biden. And the president seems really entrenched into the culture wars that he's sort of dug down into. And so that's a problem for him. But I want to circle back just quickly about something you mentioned before that, some of these battleground states. Mm. One of the ones you mentioned is North Carolina, a place where the Biden campaign is staffing up. I mean, think about that. North Carolina went to Mitt Romney in 2012. It went to Donald Trump in 2016. And suddenly now that's a battleground state. That's a state where Democrats are investing in with the idea that if they can flip that, it will give the Trump campaign one less avenue to reach that electoral college victory. It just shows you how dramatically things are changing from the last several election cycles.
It really is extraordinary because, I mean, what that requires of the president and his campaign, obviously, is to spend resources in states that should have been in his column from the start, but are not. I want to talk a little bit about the president's response. Fox News's Sean Hannity asked President Trump in an interview on Thursday about his second term agenda, if he were to win a second term. And the president, now, I mean, let's keep in mind, this is Fox News. This is Sean Hannity. This should have been a sort of easy gimme for the president. Here's how President Trump responded.
Well, one of the things that will be really great, you know, the word experience is still good. I always say talent is more important than experience. I've always said that. But the word experience is a very important word. It's in a very important meaning. I never did this before. I never slept over in Washington. I was in Washington, I think, 17 times. All of a sudden, I'm president of the United States. You know the story. I'm riding down Pennsylvania Avenue with our first lady, and I say, this is great. But I didn't know very many people in Washington. It wasn't my thing. I was from Manhattan, from New York. Now I know everybody. And I have great people in the administration. You make some mistakes, like, you know, an idiot like Bolton. All he wanted to do is drop bombs on everybody. You don't have to drop bombs on everybody. You don't have to kill people.
So, Kimberly, that was, just to remind listeners again, that was a response to the question, your second term agenda. It was a gimme. He kind of rambled incoherently about it. And there's been a lot of talk about that response in Washington, right?
Yes. I mean, he totally went off on this tangent for this question that Sean Hannity set up for him that should have been a home run. I mean, it reminded me of the interview with Ted Kennedy when he was running for president and they asked him why and he couldn't clearly articulate a reason. And that was the end of his campaign. Mm-hmm. Right now, you have a president facing multiple crises in the nation asked, you know, what are you going to do? Make your case for another term. And he starts rambling about experience and Bolton. and it really was a something that is just, it shocked a lot of people. But at the same time, it's reflective of the fact that at this point, the Trump campaign thought that it was going to be running on a strong economy and that being the cornerstone of its case. The campaign slogan was supposed to change from make America great again to keep America great. Well, America's not very great right now. America is facing a lot of challenges, including an economy that has been tanked by the pandemic. And it shows that there's really not a big pitch. There's really not a plan B of how to pitch this this campaign other than to insult and paint Joe Biden as somebody who is unable to step up at this time of a crisis. And that is not working so far.
Well, speaking of Joe Biden, he's holding virtual events. That's pretty much become his defines his campaign trail, if you will. Here he is participating in a town hall Saturday, a virtual town hall with Asian and Pacific Islander American voters.
In this moment of national and global crisis, where the racial inequities that plague our society are even more evident now than they've been. At this time, we need a president who can address every aspect of this pandemic with urgency and seriousness, including anti-AAPI bias. You know, Donald Trump only knows how to speak to people's fears, not to the better angels. He only ever speaks to place blame instead of claiming responsibility.
So former Vice President Joe Biden speaking at a recent virtual campaign event. Kimberly, my question for you about the vice president is, to what extent is Biden's advantage in this moment actually due to him? In other words, he's been largely out of sight for some time because of the pandemic. I'd argue that the current dynamic in the race has been mostly dictated by the president's missteps as opposed to Biden's positive steps.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, at the beginning of this pandemic, when everything started to shut down, my first thought was, wow, this is really catastrophic for Joe Biden's campaign because he can't campaign. And in the midst of coverage of the pandemic, he can't even break through in the news cycle. This will be really devastating. And it turned out to be the exact opposite because of President Trump's handling of the pandemic and the backlash he is receiving from that. So it ended up being a gift to Joe Biden in many ways. And so all he has to do is come out and do sort of these, make these appearances and make statements that sound very inspirational and be on the benefit of winning side of polling. That can't last, right? Because at some point he really has to make a clear pitch as to what he will do if he is elected and why this needs to be a change election. I don't think that luck will last forever. And I think that's one reason why the Trump campaign, except for the president himself, others on the Trump campaign really want to turn the corner and make this about Joe Biden, compare the president to Joe Biden and put him more front and center instead of letting the president take all of the heat.
Right. And we're going to be talking about that for the rest of the hour. We're talking about the presidential election politics and how the pandemic and economic crisis and a racial justice movement have shaken everything up. And we want to hear from you. What do you make of President Trump's response to the pandemic? To the economic crisis and to the protests across the nation. Send us a comment on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about how current events, from the pandemic to the economic crisis to the racial justice movement, is affecting the presidential campaign. We've got a great panel with us to help sort this all out. Joining me is WBUR's senior Washington correspondent, Kimberly Atkins. She's with us from Washington. And let me introduce two more to fill out our panel. Democratic strategist Joel Payne. Joel Payne, good to have you. Thanks for joining On Point today.
Thank you, Anthony.
Also with us from Atlanta is Republican pollster Whit Ayers. Whit Ayers, great to have you in this discussion as well. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Good to be with you.
So, Whit, I'll start with you. I know you were hearing Kimberly and I talking in the first segment of this program. Let me just open it up to you. How do you assess the state of this race? What's your quick headline and analysis here?
Anthony, 2020 is starting to feel a lot like 1980. when there was a pervasive sense that events are spinning out of control and we're impotent in the face of daunting challenges. We may remember that year we were about halfway through in the summer of 1980, the Iranian hostage crisis, which was making many Americans feel impotent. We had a misery index, as Ronald Reagan called it, which was the sum of the unemployment rate and the inflation rate, which was pushing 20%. And at the same time, there were a lot of doubts about whether Ronald Reagan was up to the job, you know, whether the cowboy could actually do the work of the presidency. And in the one debate that year, Ronald Reagan performed well. The polls had been very close up to that point. And then because he looked like an acceptable alternative, he ended up blowing it out at the end. The debates this fall, I think, are really, really important because of Joe Biden's age. He's got to show that he's up to the job. If he becomes an acceptable alternative, then his chances of victory increase dramatically.
And just to be clear, 1980, of course, Ronald Reagan became president. Jimmy Carter became a one-term president. And that could be what we're looking at now, but still 127 days to go to Election Day. Joel Payne, same question to you. I'd love to get your quick take on where the race is right now.
Absolutely. And I think Whit, actually, that's a really good callback. I think back to 2008, the first presidential race that I actually worked on. I worked for John Edwards, but of course that ended up being Barack Obama versus John McCain. And you had this crisis that was lingering. That was the economic crisis of 2008 on Wall Street. And it became the kind of 600-pound elephant in the room. And that was the thing that nobody else could kind of maneuver around. You had two candidates that were trying to demonstrate who could lead the country out of that moment. The difference is you did not have an incumbent president who was running for re-election. Donald Trump is an incumbent running for re-election now and trying to demonstrate that he can dig the country out of the mess that really was created under his watch. So I think that those are two good callbacks, but I think the main difference here is you've got an incumbent running as opposed to two challengers.
Mm. Joel, let me stick with you because Kimberly, I thought, both Kimberly and Whit made good points about how this race is going to evolve as we go forward. Kimberly made the point in the first segment that it's not going to stay this way because Joe Biden, in a way, has to come out. The Trump campaign is going to focus on Joe Biden and try to really articulate the difference between these two candidates. And Whit Ayers made the great point, I think, that a lot is going to rise on these debates. As a Democratic advisor, what would you have Biden do between now and Election Day to sort of, hold on to as much of this advantage that he seems to have at this current moment?
So I'm a boxing fan, so I'm going to use a lazy sports metaphor here. I think Biden is perfectly executing the rope-a-dope, which is essentially allowing Trump to exhaust himself with whatever issue of the day is coming up, and not letting Trump lay a glove on him. And that's really what's been happening. Trump has been musing about everything from Confederate statues to Supreme Court cases to whether or not he slipped down a railing speaking to our servicemen and women at West Point. And Biden has been very measured with his public statement. And you're giving your opponent less to hit. And for Trump, that means he's creating all the news. And, you know, Kimberly actually talked about earlier how Trump's people want to make this a referendum. I agree with Kimberly's reporting, but I disagree with whatever Trump insider, shared that insight, because I actually think Joe Biden wants this to be a referendum. If this is a one-to-one choice, if people are going into the booth choosing between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that's a loser for Donald Trump, because the presidency is such a different choice than any other electoral office. It's really about who do you want to spend the next 4 years with. And I think what we're seeing is fatigue on the part of voters who are just tired of all of the chaos that the Trump years have created. Whether or not you like conservative judges or lower taxes or less regulation, all the things that come with that, with your friends arguing about politics, with people maybe thinking that you have outdated racial attitudes because you support Donald Trump. That's a real problem. That's a lot of baggage. So I think that one-to-one choice is a problem for President Trump and for his campaign.
Hmm. Whit Ayers, it seems like what the Trump campaign is talking about doing now. I'm looking at a piece in Politico where they're quoting sources inside of the Trump campaign and the Trump administration that acknowledge that the president needs to sort of change course. Do you have any sense if President Trump has the ability to change course? Because it seems like what has powered him so far in his political career is a kind of gut reaction to things that for a while served him very well. But I'm wondering if there is evidence in this man's political DNA, if you will, that he's able to adapt and change course.
Well, Anthony, I suspect if the people running the campaign were making the calls rather than the president, you would be seeing a number of different decisions being made. The president is basically using exactly the same message he used in 2016. The country has changed, but his message has not. It's interesting to compare this period to Bill Clinton, who in 1994 was shellacked, or at least his party was shellacked in the midterm elections that year, with Republicans picking up 52 seats in the House and taking control. Bill Clinton did a reset. We call it now, or he called it triangulation between the Democrats.
I think we might have lost Whit Ayers. Whit Ayers, are you still with us? Well, we're going to work on getting Whit Ayers back. Kimberly, I'll come to you with this with the same sort of question that I asked Whit. Your sense of whether President Trump and his campaign have the wherewithal, the political DNA, or are signaling in any way that they're, you know, Whit Ayers talked about Bill Clinton's reset. Any sense that the Donald Trump White House campaign is able to react like that?
No, because that campaign is run entirely from the top. President Trump has always believed he is his best strategist. He is his best communications manager. He is his best press secretary. And so even as members of the campaign try to change messaging, try to revamp, it's impossible to do so long as the president and his Twitter handle are doing something differently. You see that both in the way he campaigns and in the way he governs. I mean, as late as in the last couple of days, more members of his administration, for example, including Vice President Mike Pence, are now talking about the pandemics, urging people to do things like wear face masks, something that the president has steadfastly refused to do. He commented that he doesn't like the look of a mask and has really been a lead proponent of this idea that that is not necessary. And folks who support him have followed suit. We've seen in the rallies that he held, very few, if anybody, was wearing a mask. And that, according to health officials, is a bad sign. That's something that is one reason why we are seeing the persistent uptick in cases of the coronavirus. That's a prime example of how the president overrides any other messaging that happens. And a point that Whit made that is right on point is that the country has changed. Even when the president refuses to, the country hasn't. In 2016, when the president disparaged Black Lives Matter, it was largely accepted by a lot of Republicans, and the movement was dismissed as something fringe. Now the vast majority of Americans support that movement, and the president still has the same message to disparage it and try to paint that as some sort of enemy to him and his administration and the country. So it's that lack of dexterity and stubbornness in the president's message that seems to be harming him the most right now.
I think we have Whit Ayers back, which I'm happy to report. Whit, you were talking when we lost you about Bill Clinton's ability to reset when sort of the political chips looked down for him. We're talking about following the midterm election during his first term, right?
Right, right. Sorry, I lost you there for a moment. Yeah, after the midterm elections in 1994, when Republicans and Newt Gingrich took over the House, Bill Clinton adjusted rather dramatically in a way that caused his liberal supporters some angst. He talked about triangulation between the Republicans, the Democrats, and the presidency. But he ended up passing some enormously important legislation, including legislation that gave us the first balanced budgets in decades. So Bill Clinton was a remarkably agile politician. President Trump needs to be similarly agile so that he can adapt to meet the moment for his reelection campaign.
And what would that look like, Whit, if you were advising him? Agile around which issues, for example?
Obviously, the major issues facing the country, the pandemic, the economic revival, and the whole Black Lives Matter movement, that would require a substantial reset. But presidents need to meet the moment, and we need him to adjust his message from 2016 to meet those three enormous challenges.
Right. Joel, I want to move on to Joe Biden a little bit. And the story becomes complicated in a sense, because in a real way, Biden, who's going to be the Democratic nominee, thanks largely to African-American voters. I mean, we shouldn't forget that his campaign was pretty much dead in the water until the South Carolina primary, where he was lifted back into contention by black votes. At the same time, he has this complicated history as one of the architects of the 1994 crime bill, which many critics say resulted in all kinds of terrible effects, including a generation of incarcerated African Americans. So is he the right messenger for this time? And how does he respond to that?
I'll address Biden just really quickly on your last topic, and then I promise I'll get to your question about Biden.
Sure.
On Trump, what's interesting to me there is that he would be the first, I'm just looking back in recent political history, the first incumbent who tries to run a reelection campaign without reaching out to try to add to his coalition. There seems to be no desire to bring in new voters. It's all based on like the old playbook. In 2012, Barack Obama reached out to moderates. He named a moderate chief of staff. He talked about balancing the federal budget and about, lowering the federal deficit. Bill Clinton in 1996 talked about school uniforms. You know, Ronald Reagan ran a very different campaign in 84 than in 80. So Trump is really going against the headwinds of history by trying to do it in this way. I guess 2016 makes anything possible, but I do think that's important to underscore that Trump is really trying to do something that we really haven't seen done in modern political history. On your question about Biden, and black voters have behaved very pragmatically this cycle. Through their votes and through their activism, black voters, particularly older black voters, particularly in the more southern parts of the country, have told you what Joe Biden's utility is that he can win. They are okay with Joe Biden being less than perfect on civil rights issues in the past, on the crime bill in the past, the busing issue that he and Kamala Harris sparred about in the debates a couple of months ago. The black voters have told you we're okay with those imperfections because we believe Joe Biden can get the job done and can beat Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the existential crisis that black voters are trying to address. They are not looking for perfect in a candidate. If they were looking for perfect, they had two very promising African-American candidates that they got behind. They had people like Elizabeth Warren, the people like Bernie Sanders, who would have certainly had a more progressive vision of the world that they could have gotten behind. Black voters said, we want the candidate that we feel most confident can win. And I think that's always important when you think about the prism of Joe Biden and why he is the quote unquote chosen one for so many black voters.
Kimberly, Joel said something that I find really striking. I want to ask you about, 2016 makes anything possible. And I'm just sort of asking you as a reporter with your ear to the ground among Democrats who sort of, look at the polling, look at their position, feel pretty good about this, but it's like, oh my God, don't forget 2016, don't get overconfident. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. Not only is 2016 fresh in the minds of every Democrat, but also just the volatility of the news cycle, as I mentioned before, how quickly things have changed, how long 2020, the year 2020 has already been with everything that has happened. So there is a sense that nothing is to be taken for granted. But at the same time, Democrats, both when in terms of the presidential campaign and also the very, very consequential congressional campaigns that are coming up, particularly on the Senate side, are working very hard, too, to try to make another case. I mean, at the same time, consider this week, a few days after the Trump administration asked the Supreme Court to strike down what is left of Obamacare. Today, Democrats will vote in the House to expand Obamacare. It's moves like that that is trying to remind voters, hey, if Democrats are in control, we will actually be getting things done. And Republicans just sort of falling behind Donald Trump saying, hey, we're already on this winning message. We are making America great again, and really not having much beyond that message right now because, again, Donald Trump is at the top of it. So Democrats up and down the ticket are trying to make this differentiation the same way that, as we pointed out, Joe Biden at some point is going to have to come out and be more forceful about what he is going to do, as opposed to just being this alternative to Donald Trump that's waiting in the wings.
Kimberly Atkins, Joel Payne, Whitair, stand by. We're talking, listeners, about how current events, from the pandemic to the economic crisis to the racial justice movement, are all affecting the presidential campaign. We want to hear from you. You can chime in on social media at On Point Radio. We'll get to some of your questions after this break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. On tomorrow's program, we're going to talk about Democratic nominee Joe Biden's potential running mates. And we want to hear from you. What do you think? Who should he pick as his running mate and why? Make your case. Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Again, 617-353-0683. Tell us who you think Joe Biden should pick as a running mate and why. Today, we're talking about the presidential election, how the pandemic and accompanying economic crisis and the protests over police killings have shaken up the race. I'm joined by WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, Democratic strategist Joel Payne, and Republican pollster Whit Ayers. And I want to welcome On Point producer Dori Scheimer into the program. She joins us from Pittsburgh, and she's been monitoring our social media feed. And Dori, good to have you.
Yeah, thank you. We are hearing from a lot of voters on Facebook and on Twitter talking about how these current events that you've been talking about are impacting their vote. Victor on Facebook said the coronavirus is apolitical. It infects and kills people without regard for their political beliefs. You'd think we'd be able to put aside partisan politics in the face of this killer, but we haven't. And instead of unifying us, President Trump has exacerbated our differences and fractured our response to the disease. He calls it a total failure of leadership.
All right. What else? Are there some comments on the other side of the ledger, I guess?
Yeah, this person makes an interesting point about kind of the decisions voters in the middle are making. Dana on Facebook said that COVID-19 and the response from this administration made her want to vote against President Trump, but then seeing images of riots and vandalism made me want to vote for Trump. She is questioning why Vice President Biden and liberal supporters were encouraging protests during the pandemic and questioned the logic behind that.
All right. Dori Scheimer, thanks so much. Whit Ayers, let me come to you on that last point, because one of the points that Donald Trump has been making is he wants to sort of run on law and order. We heard there from a listener, Dana, on Facebook, talking about concern about the rioting and some of the protests that have perhaps not remained peaceful. How potent an issue do you think that is for the president?
Extremely potent. I can't imagine a better slogan for the Trump reelection campaign than defund the police. The overreaction of the left helped reelect Scott Walker as governor of Wisconsin, the Republican governor there. Tearing down statues of abolitionists and destroying things willy-nilly is the best argument for a strong Republican president to put down lawlessness and outrageous behavior on the part of the left. So if the Democrats want to reelect Donald Trump, I would strongly encourage them to adopt defund the police as their leading slogan.
Hmm. Well, Joel Payne, Joe Biden has not embraced defund the police, but you know, going back to our listener on Facebook talking about this, does this send out a caution, I guess, to Joe Biden around this issue?
Not at all, in my opinion. I think, the president and his allies would hope that that type of negative stigma would stick to Biden or would create a, windstorm of support for the president. But that really hasn't happened. I mean, those protests have been in the bloodstream for about a month. And we've just seen that the president is experiencing his lowest watermark in his poll numbers and kind of recorded history of the Trump presidency. I think what that suggests to me is that most voters are pretty savvy in kind of understanding the games that the president's playing here. They also understand that Joe Biden has actually been very measured in his response. I think he has provided support and provided some cover to the peaceful protesters who are arguing for humanity and for racial equality. But he's also drawn a pretty strict red line about folks who are going above and beyond, which I think we should all point out are a very, very small fraction of the people who've been out there peacefully protesting. So I think voters have a little bit more savvy here than maybe that question might suppose. I think the president is disadvantaged here because he speaks the language of division. Donald Trump has never done anything politically with any success by bringing people together. He won in 2016 because he was the less unpopular of two candidates. And I say that as someone who worked for that other unpopular candidate, Hillary Clinton. He didn't win because people trusted his ability to be a uniter or bring people together. He won because he was able to divide and he was able to suppress the vote, which, that is a measure of political skill. He is out of his depth in this environment, which requires a president to be a healer and a uniter and somebody to bring people together. And I think that's the quandary that the Trump campaign faces, is that their candidate, they can change campaign managers. Brad Parscale can be replaced. They can replace state directors. They can try out new messages. But at the end of the day, their candidate is who their candidate is. And by the way, that's not just important for the Trump campaign. That's important for Republicans up and down the ticket all across the country.
Hmm. Whit Ayers, you know, coming back to this issue around law and order and the way President Trump would like to run on that, it brings to mind Richard Nixon, who, of course, did that fairly successfully. But the difference, key difference, was Nixon, of course, was running as a challenger against an incumbent in sort of turbulent times. So he could talk about restoring law and order as a way of changing things around. It seems to me Trump has a bit of a challenge here in that whatever's going on now is happening under his watch. Doesn't that add to the sort of complicated nature of this messaging?
It does. The change argument worked in Donald Trump's favor in 2016. The change argument works more for Joe Biden's favor in 2020. And Joel's right. Joe Biden's a lot harder to demonize than a woman who talked about the deplorables. He's a much milder personality. The Trump campaign is clearly going to try to make this a choice. But he's a harder guy to demonize than Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Kimberly, I want to bring you back in on this. Sort of your take on this effort by the Trump campaign to run on law and order and sort of, you know, get things like defund the police to stick to Joe Biden.
Yeah, you know, I think one additional key difference in what's happening now compared to the strategy that Nixon used, which was an extension of sort of the Southern strategy, right, where you're appealing to largely white voters in an effort to put together a majority, is that President Trump is losing the folks in the suburbs, particularly women, white women. You are seeing, I keep going back to this image, but you see white soccer moms in the suburbs holding Black Lives Matter signs. It's a different time, and the same sort of silent majority that the president keeps tweeting about, it's becoming less and less clear that that exists for him. So he is banking on the fact that a lot of people feel just like that listener who said that defunding the police sounds scary and there is lawlessness and you need a Republican to stop it. I think fewer and fewer people see that. They see the problem with it, with systemic racism in law enforcement that keeps resulting in these images of unarmed Black people dying in the street. And so I think, again, the culture has shifted, the culture has changed, and we aren't, I'm not so sure that that is going to be the same kind of winning message that the president is hoping that it will be.
Hmm. Joel, one of the things that the pandemic has done, and for that matter, the racial justice protests as well, is put a spotlight on some of these systematic inequities and weaknesses of our society and economy in general. And I'm thinking of things like access to healthcare, access to housing, fairness around the minimum wage, the exaggerated economic disparity that you see in this country, particularly around race. So my question is, to what extent do you see these issues driving the presidential debate in the coming weeks and months?
I think what's fascinating is when the current crises that we are dealing with happened in the calendar. Can you imagine if this happened 6 months before they did, when Bernie Sanders was kind of the leading Democratic candidate?
Yeah.
You could have had a very different Democratic nominee. And I bring that up just to say that, you know, even though Joe Biden is center left, I think is how most people would describe him, he's running in an environment that's very advantageous, with the wind at the back to folks who have a more progressive idea of America and what America should be. And I think he's going to benefit from that. But the environment and the energy behind him is certainly progressive. I think the old kind of, truism was that America was kind of a center right country. I kind of think the center shifted a bit. I think America is at minimum a center left country, and maybe even trending a little bit further on some social issues like gay marriage, like racial equality, etc. So it's absolutely going to play, I think, a background role in the election. Look, at the end of the day, it's about, do people feel secure physically? Do people feel secure with their paychecks? Do people feel like, they have some sort of, kind of positive future economically? I think those are going to be the issues that drive the election. And I think that those background issues that you bring up are certainly going to be kind of secondary issues, but I don't know if they will replace the pocketbook issues that always drive elections.
Mm. Whitairs, what do you think? Love to hear your response to that.
I think Joel's right about the country moving left on some social issues. I still think the country is center right on economic issues and the role of government. They want to have a major area for the private sector to take initiative and to create jobs and provide innovation. So I think on economic issues, the country remains center right. But there's no doubt that we've got to get control over this coronavirus before our economy will have any chance of taking off. And that's a major weight on the entire government right now.
In the couple of minutes that remain, I want to turn to the Senate. And Whitairs, I'll stick with you on this. Again, I think before this, the sort of shape of this race was dramatically affected by the pandemic, by the economic crisis, and by these racial justice protests. It looked like a much steeper hill for the Democrats to climb to retake the Senate. Now, it's still a challenge. They still have to win a whole lot more than they lose. But what's your quick view of what the race for control of the Senate looks like?
The Senate is in play. There are a number of states that are closer now than they were 3 months ago. But it also helps to remember that in 2000, a great many Republican candidates ran well ahead of Donald Trump in their states. Marco Rubio got 600,000 more votes in Florida, for example, than Donald Trump. He won by 8 percentage points, while Trump won by 1. Rob Portman in Ohio also got more than 600,000 more votes than Donald Trump. But the same was true with Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, Grassley in Iowa, Toomey in Pennsylvania, Tillis in North Carolina. So just because the president is running behind in those states doesn't necessarily mean that the Republican Senate candidates are also going to run behind based on what happened in 2016.
Interesting. Joel, on the other hand, I can look at polling in states like Arizona, Colorado, Maine, Montana, North Carolina, even Iowa, and they're pretty close, and Democrats have advantages in a lot of those states.
Anthony, I'm going to use a term, wave. Wave is the term I'm going to use, and I think in a wave Democratic year, I think Joni Ernst is in trouble in Iowa. I think Martha McSally is in trouble regardless in Arizona. I think both of those Georgia seats are in trouble in a wave year. You know, in a lot of ways in 2016, it worked the other way for Republicans, where there were a lot of wave Republican seats. You know, someone like Claire McCaskill, she lost her seat, I think, in a bad time to run, you know, as a Democrat. I think it's going to be a rough time to run as a Republican with this person at the top of the ticket if he does not fundamentally change his approach, because Donald Trump is not giving any room for other people, other types of Republicans to run. If you're Susan Collins, you have to run to the right in Maine, because so much of the Republican base is charged up behind Trump. You lose that base and you can't play to the middle because you've been a Trump supporter. Same with Cory Gardner in Colorado. Same with Tom Tillis in North Carolina. I think Democrats feel very bullish about the Senate this time around. And I think, you know, there's a very real scenario that Chuck Schumer could be the majority leader come this time next year. Mm.
Well, Joel Payne, he's a Democratic strategist and CBS political analyst. Joel, thanks so much for joining us today. We're so grateful.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Whit Ayers, he's a Republican pollster at North Star Opinion Research, and he's consulted on many Republican campaigns. Whit, always great talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
Enjoyed being with you, Anthony.
Really enjoyed having you. And Kimberly Atkins, stay with me for the last couple of minutes. I'd love to get your take on the Senate as well before we sort of do a concluding question. What race are you watching with most interest there?
Oh, I'm watching all of these races in the Senate. I mean, just a reminder that Democrats would need either 3 or 4 seats in order to gain control of the Senate, depending on the outcome of the presidential election. And we have just been talking about, what, 6 or 7 mm-hmm. Different races. And we haven't even brought up Doug Jones, who is trying to hold on to his seat in very, very red Alabama, probably the reddest state in the union. It's not going to be easy for him to do so, but it's not out of the realm of possibility for a Democrat to be reelected in the Senate in Alabama. So, yeah, all of these races are really tight. Remember, Susan Collins, to go back to that, she's the last Republican in all of New England. States like Maine and Massachusetts, they would routinely send Republicans to Washington. And that has changed so much. And just today, the Supreme Court handed down an opinion that protected abortion, that shut down an abortion law in Louisiana. But both of the most recent Supreme Court justices who Collins supported, Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, she said that she thought they would uphold abortion rights. Both of them voted on the other side. So that just made her election a lot more difficult. There are so many issues going on in the Senate race, and that's where a lot of energy is going to be.
Lots to watch between now and November 3rd. Kimberly Atkins, she's my colleague here at WBUR, senior Washington correspondent for us. Kimberly, always great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Anthony.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.